With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next conversation is with a South African filmmaker who's going to be premiering her new film, High Fantasy, at the Toronto International Film Festival world premiere, actually, and it's a very interesting film. I don't know if I'd want to call it experimental, but the whole film was shot on an iPhone, and I think from a technological perspective, you need to see the film, but more importantly, I think you need to dive into the story and what actually is unfolding. It's a road movie like you haven't seen before, it seems to me. And it's been said that Jenna Bass is our guest today, is a part of the new wave of South African filmmaking, and I totally can understand why. This is a film about relationships and prejudice and technology and reconciliation. Jenna refers to it as a selfie film. What does that mean? We talk about anger and sexuality and politics and race and power and oppression, and can reconciliation ever really happen? And how we're all sort of in this together and equally responsible. She refers to the film as a political satire, and it's really quite brilliant in its making, and the cinematography, the film, the photography is just, it's remarkable when you start to think about how this film was made. It's a part of, which was kind of interesting and new for me, part of the body swap genre. And you're going to have to listen in to find out exactly what that's all about. But it's a film you're going to want to see, and a conversation I hope you're going to not only enjoy, but listen to right now. Coming right up, Jenna Bass and her new film, High Fantasy. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and speaking. Also, facetofacelive.ca for all of my interviews, and rabble.ca for more info about all things political and social. Coming right up, Jenna Bass, High Fantasy. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by another very special guest today. Filmmaker Jenna Bass is here with us to talk about her new film, High Fantasy. And I think she's actually sitting a long way away from us currently. We are not, sadly, face to face. Jenna, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you're currently in South Africa. That's a big place. Where actually might you be if we had a GPS we could find you with?
Well, that's a little bit scary.
That's exactly right.
I'm in Cape Town. I hope that's specific. I could tell you the suburb, but I don't know if that's going to mean very much
to
anyone listening in Canada. But Cape Town.
We don't need that much detail. It's just, you know, I'm old enough to still marvel at the fact that you and I are even having a conversation right now that's clear, and that's not costing me $125.
Yeah,
it's pretty
amazing,
pretty remarkable. Hey, listen, congratulations on High Fantasy. What a remarkable film! I was astounded by not only the technique and the more I found out about how you filmed it, and I really hope you'll tell us a little bit more about that, but also the story and the way this unfolds in front of us. I mean, this is a film about pretty much everything. I don't know that you leave any issues out in this film, and you tell it in a really compelling and an engaging and entertaining way. Can you talk a little bit about, without too many spoilers, can you tell us a bit about maybe this story, and then we could go from there?
Sure. So it's, I guess I'm kind of calling it like a political satire that's shot on phones, like a selfie. So it's a selfie movie. And it's about a group of four young South African friends who go on a camping trip together. And they kind of, in their friendship group, they represent different genders, different races, different kind of like, you know, different kind of like symbols of like this, of the new generation of South Africans. And they travel up to this very, very isolated farm in our Northern Cape province where it's, you know, just this farm where there's absolutely nothing around them. And they wake up in their tent to discover that they swap bodies and they have to kind of deal with the kind of very complicated, like, situation they find themselves in. Not only do they not know how to get back into their bodies, but they're also stuck with all the kind of baggage of post-apartheid South Africa and the so-called rainbow nation that they're supposed to be living in, where everything's supposed to be fine between them, but it's absolutely not. So it's a film that deals with everything in the sense that, you know, everything is related to everything. You know, a lot of these issues are politically connected, and the body swap premise was a way of exploring that.
So right out of the gate, I mean, I couldn't help but think of Blair Witch Project way back when, with the way the camera was kind of turned on. That was kind of the first sort of cinematic selfie, in a way, I suppose, that was really used in a long sort of format. But you really take it to another level, because you've got each one of these characters kind of filming themselves, editing themselves. It's got, there's a documentary like edge to it. Then you've got the subject matter. I mean, I just wrote a quick list: memory, identity, prejudice, history, respect, friendship, reconciliation, politics. I mean, the list is really, so what the heck is this film about, Jenna?
Well, I think it's a film that kind of relates to a lot of, in a way, very specifically South African problems that are as a result of, you know, not just, you know, our apartheid era, but, you know, the years of colonialism and kind of exploitation of our indigenous people over the past few hundred years. But that is not at all unique to South Africa. I just often think of, like, South Africa as this, like, we have these things in a very extreme and very visible way, whereas I think other countries are perhaps better at covering it up or have better, like, PR, you know? Whereas in South Africa, these problems are so vivid that you can't really ignore them. And so by kind of highlighting them, and the way that they're all connected, and that you can't really have a conversation here about race, without talking about land, without talking about gender, without, you know, kind of having all these discussions together and realizing the kind of really, like, systematic oppression under which most of the population is living, that, you know, like, this is a very South African story, but it's also, like, absolutely not unique to here, unfortunately. It's been really, really interesting to hear people who've watched the film from other countries kind of drawing parallels, and also interesting when people refuse to see the parallels, because just because these things might not be visible to you in your bubble does not mean that your country is not, like, you know, just as messed up as we are. So it's I mean, I can give you the synopsis, but then when it comes to, like, giving a synopsis of the themes, it's actually a lot more complicated.
Absolutely, yeah. As are, you know, I suppose any sort of history or just even relationships. And I mean, I think you tease that out so beautifully, the complex nature of growing up, of having friends, of having different opinions. I mean, it seems like, to me, on a certain level, this film is about so many things to me. And again, congratulations on it. But one of the things is, you know, is this about listening? You know, I found that some of the characters in the film really, I didn't get the sense they were listening to each other, especially once the body change, once the shift had sort of taken place. There was just so much anger, or at least it seemed like anger on the surface. Maybe it was just this, wow, what has actually happened here? And now I'm being flooded with all these questions and all this uncertainty about, you know, frankly, what things that most of us are dealing with who haven't switched bodies with other people.
That's a very interesting point, because you know, I think part of the thing that also motivated me to kind of tell this particular kind of story within a kind of body swap genre was just the the kind of body swap films that I had seen, which the usual, I mean, unless they're a horror body swap film, which is not like kind of like a very small amount of most body swap movies from what I've seen. They're usually about like, these two people don't understand each other.
Right.
They need to switch places and learn about each other in order to understand and reach reconciliation. And that's essentially been this narrative of our country. You know, we've had, you know, like spectacularly traumatic history that has been supposedly reconciled. Mm. And, you know, we've literally had a truth and reconciliation committee in which people listened to each other and were supposed to actually then understand and forgive and forget. And that has been completely unsuccessful, if we can judge by, you know, the current kind of status quo and the way that people are feeling. And so I think, you know, for me, it is very interesting to explore the fact that listening to somebody, even if you aren't listening, but even if you are listening, like beyond a certain point, what good is listening if you're not doing anything about it?
Right.
Yes, the characters are not listening to each other, but I think it's also because they've been listening for so long without results, and listening for something that's never going to come. So
are they
kind of
Jenna? Are they listening? Are they listening without empathy? Do you think is that kind of what, maybe what's missing?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's like who should be empathetic to who? Because right. I mean, I think. You know, like, I think that's the thing is, I mean, I think what we think about the body swap concept is also is like these two people are equally, you know, in a difficult situation, and they're equally responsible to get out of it.
Right.
And that's really the question is that really the case? And does everyone need to be listening equally right now? Or maybe has one person had the microphone for too long already? Right. And have they already told the story their own way for the past 20, 30, 40, however many years? And so that's really the question is, I suppose, who should really be listening to who at this point? Yeah. And I don't know if it's even about empathy at this, you know, it's about like practically like rectifying sure. things that have not been rectified. So yeah, I mean, I absolutely do not have answers for
yeah, sure.
what should be done, but it's very complicated.
Lexi, at one point, I think your sort of you cross-cut the film with these almost these documentary-like interviews, and mm-hmm. Lexi kind of referring back to her character and the shift and some of the changes she went through, and she says, you know, that's not really a question I want to answer right now, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. and I kind of smiled and thought, isn't that part of the problem that
yeah.
not with her necessarily, mm-hmm. but with all of the characters, the country, and frankly, all of us really, you know, don't even ask me the question because I'm not going to go there.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I do think that some of the character, I mean, at least, you know, at the very least one of the characters, namely Polly is, she goes there. Like, I think she's answering these questions quite honestly. And of course, like, you know, she's got a whole lot of other kind of personal baggage that, you know, is influencing the way that she's talking and what she's talking about. And by no means like being like, I would say the hero or like the like perfect person,
right.
You know, like, I don't think any story should really have that, but I do think that she's the one person who like confronts things mm. as they are. You know, the only kind of way in which she sort of like panders is, you know, towards the person who's asking the questions, which is me in the film. And kind of like, she actually says, you know, like, okay, I don't know if you really want me to answer that question, I'll answer, you know, it's like, you know, so she'll sometimes do things like that, but she calls a spade a spade. So
right.
I do think that, you know, I think that's the process that this youth generation is going through at the moment with our, I don't know how much you know about our kind of university protests over the past 2 years, but young people are basically saying, we want to speak the truth, we want to say what's on our mind, and that's going to hurt people, but it's necessary.
Yeah, I would say it's absolutely necessary. I would say it's necessary in our political positions we take, it's necessary with respect to the our exploitative economic systems around the world, our families, you know. I mean, I was raised in a family that really didn't entertain a whole lot of questioning, you know. And when you did ask questions and ask good questions, they were often just sort of ignored or swept under the carpet. And it ultimately drove me to philosophy, actually, which is kind of ironic. It's entirely rooted in questions, it seems to me. Can you tell me a little bit about the technology and the filmmaking itself? I mean, you know, did you decide to shoot it on an iPhone because you just didn't want to be bothered trying to find the money to shoot it differently? Or was it a really intentional kind of narrative choice, in a sense. You know, there's a great moment, and I can't remember who it was, but somebody says in the film, can you imagine the YouTube views we're going to get if we we were captured? You know, if we, and then somebody said, yeah, that's the last thing that we need to be worried about right now. But it just struck me as such an interesting question in the context.
Yeah. It was kind of both, both alternatives you mentioned. I knew from the get-go this was going to be a micro-budget film because I wanted to make a film quickly, and the only way you can really do that is if it's going to be micro-budget. So I was already prepared in my mind to kind of shoot it on whatever I could basically wrangle for free. And a documentary filmmaker who I was working for at that point kind of offered for me to use his iPhone that he had. And so then I wasn't even sure if he meant it seriously, because I think he, in his mind, it's like, why would you want to shoot a film on an iPhone? But he said I could. So I take these offers very seriously, and I started thinking about it. And then I just kind of decided, okay, we'll shoot it on the iPhone because it's what I've got. And why, you know, as you say, why bother looking further if we've got a camera that's going to work and it'll probably be sufficient. And then I kind of realized, wait, actually, this is perfect, because this is the generation that we're speaking about. This is the tool that they use. This is the visual language that they're used to. And if you were going to swap bodies with someone, the first thing that these people would do would be to take a selfie, basically. Right. So it ended up being, once I kind of connected the dots, it became something we really explored, and like the kind of aesthetic and technical language of camera phones became like something we really explored and tried to use on multiple levels all the time.
It's almost like they'd be taking an anti-selfie, isn't it? Because it was, they'd be taking a picture of somebody who was no longer themselves. Anyway, that's just a weird idea. But anyway.
That's a really good question.
Yeah, that's funny. But you know what's so beautiful about your film? You can watch this and just kind of come away and go, wow, that was great, had a great time, and come back to it. I think you know, students will be able to study this film. I think you could. I mean, we could write essays about these. You know, we joked a little bit about not having enough time for our interview today, and I think I'm already starting to feel that frustration. It's really, really wonderful and remarkable, and utterly brilliant that you shot it on an iPhone. I can't believe the photography. I mean, it's stunning. Some of the images you have are absolutely gorgeous.
It's funny though, because I mean, I was actually saying this to someone earlier, like now that, you know, we're promoting the film and getting it out there, I've had quite a few people have been saying to me like, wow, the film, I can't believe it was shot on a phone. Like, it looks so good. And I'm like, when we buy our phones, we all check the specs. Like, we know what our phones are capable of. Many of us have iPhones. Like, we should not be surprised.
That's,
you know,
right.
we buy these phones because they're fancy and because they can do really great things. And I think it's more just like the amazement that there's this kind of unspoken rule that you have to shoot films in a certain way, more so than it is that we don't think that this device is capable, because we know that it is. You know, we checked all the reviews online, so like we know what it is.
I love Jenna how that even in itself is speaking truth to power. You know, we don't need all your technological crap. We can manage this on our own. Thanks very much. We've got it in our hands.
Well, no, exactly. For me, making films, I mean, I do make films in my kind of more conventional ways too. And like my next project is something more along those lines. But I think it's really, really important to, like, you can't, you know, I work in a film industry where there's very, very little access to resources. Like, there's a few people who got access and then most people don't. And that is stopping them from making films. So it's very important to me to figure out how to make films in a way that not only I can do, but that other people can do as well. And so shooting on phones is like something that I've been kind of wanting to explore for a while, because it's something that people can do. And maybe the phone that we used was fancier than a lot of other people's phones, but you could still do it on a smartphone. It's not a reason to not tell your story, basically.
It's beautiful. Love it. Can you tell me a little bit about the aerial shots? I mean, are the gods in fact crazy in South Africa? Is this what's happening here? Some sort of nemesis going on? Is this is it the forefathers? But I love the aerial shots. And I love the way you use shadows. I mean, it's stunning.
Thank you. Similarly, like with the drone shots, so that's the only part of the film that's not shot on a phone.
Right.
Was the drone. And that was also because the same filmmaker kind of also like very casually said, oh, if you want to borrow my drone, you can borrow it. So I was like, okay. So yeah, I kind of just take when people offer me stuff, like I always tell people, like, don't offer to work on my films for free because I will actually make you do it.
We now have that on record, so we can get that out on the street.
I paid everyone on this film. That can also be on record.
Yes.
Also, something that might interest you is also like the film. Everyone was paid equally, in about what their role or their like level of experience. Because that was also something that's very important to me. Was film structures that, you know, the way I was taught to make films, like, extremely hierarchical, with certain people having like super amounts of power and sure. other people just being kind of bossed around, and like. That doesn't make me comfortable. So in a lot of ways, the film was like quite a, you know, for me, like quite an important social experiment to like see like how can humans work together in a way that is not unjust. And not to say that this film is like the be all and end all answer. And I'm sure there's many, many, much work to do, you know, beyond what I just did. But yeah, it was part of like that exploration for me is like, actually, how do you be a decent human being? Mm. Yeah.
Well, I think, yeah, you must have some comments to make about collaboration and community and I mean, how long did it take you to shoot? How long were you crammed into the tent together and in the car and so on, you know?
We shot for about 2.5 weeks on location in the Northern Cape. So we all went up there and stayed there together, and the farmhouse that you see in the film is where we all lived. So we had to clear out all our stuff and then move it all back in. And it was, the cast and crew was 10 people. So we were all staying in that house. And 2.5 weeks, and then we came back and shot a few more days in Cape Town, which most of which is not actually in the film. Mm. The end.
So you didn't answer my question about the gods being crazy. Is there some sort of retribution going on here?
Well, I mean, yeah, it was, sometimes I kind of like, some decisions I make like from an intellectual basis, and some I make from like an instinctual basis, and sure. I kind of figure out what they meant afterwards. And that was something that, because I had access to a drone, I was like, what could I do with this? And I kind of, for my last film, my last feature, also had a kind of similar device of, it was completely improvised rather than partially improvised like this one. And improvisation tends to be very talky and like very busy and like often shouty. And I needed these, you need a break in it. And it's very hard to find a break in improvisation when you're kind of in that zone. So I wanted a kind of way of just like giving breathers, in the film, and I kind of thought that these drone shots would be just one way of doing that. But at the same time, only I realized afterwards the poignancy of it is, you know, the one of the major discourses of the film is that this is about land, and we're going to show you the land, like we're going to show you how much land there is and how much pain this land has caused, and like how much, you know, life and death is caught up in the space, you know, that's just there. And it's like, wait, and what has been there for way longer than humans have been there. So it's, yeah, I kind of want to kind of bring home the kind of gravitas of the space. And so that, I suppose, not that I'm not really interested in why they actually swap bodies. But I do like to think that, you know, like this was going to happen in this place. This place had something to do with it.
Right. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the photography is stunning. I mean, there's so many different places you could go. I mean, to say that the landscape is a character is almost an oversimplification. I mean, it's just, and I love the fact that it was a more of an intuitive, instinctual, intentional decision that you made that actually, you know, when you look back, you go, wow, that is a part of the story. This is a part of the thread and the narrative. And that speaks to you, I think, as a director and to where you're heading. And it's very Mike Lee, isn't it? I mean, isn't that...
Oh my gosh. You're the first person to say it finally. I love Mike Lee. I often think that, like, I actually hope Mike Lee doesn't find out how much I love him, because he would actually be really disappointed with my films, because I really bastardize his process. Like, because I take huge amounts of inspiration, but I never have the resources to really do the proper work that he does, in terms of like 6 months of rehearsal. And so I really, really butcher the way that he works, but I'm hugely inspired by it. Thank you for noticing. Also with the drone shot thing, you know, the other kind of instinctual aspect, I just really wanted to see like this giant pizza, like inflatable pizza from an aerial perspective. That was really my motivation.
which is just hysterical to me. That's a very absurd shot, the blowing up of the slice of pizza. It's quite wonderful. It's a it's an image that's going to stick with me for some time. I mean, you've lived it. So many of us, I suppose, have lived it in a particular way. Canada, we've got huge issues with reconciliation and Indigenous First Nations, Métis and Inuit folk. It's continuing to be a part of the conversation here almost on a daily basis. Is it even possible? You know, some people would, you know, I remember working in Cambodia many years ago, and somebody said something to the effect of, oh, Cambodia's problems will be solved with, you know, several hundred funerals. You know, so once those people in positions of power are gone, we're going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I don't think it's that simple. I think it's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, to be honest, I definitely don't. I don't know. I mean, I kind of sway from like being kind of somewhat optimistic, but generally, I suppose pessimistic because we're in a really, you know, our world is in a very bad situation. But I mean, I don't know. I know less about the world than I know about my country. I don't even know that much about that. But you know, the film is interesting on that level because on one hand, you know, it was this collaboration between different people of different races and different backgrounds, and it's been somewhat successful in that we've finished it. It's, you know, it's going to Toronto. It's, you know, it's by many respects, it's a successful film, whether or not one likes it or not. But at the same time, the kind of outcome of the workshopping of the story, which is about can these four friends reconcile, is no, they can't. It's like irreversibly damaged. And these four, you really, you know, like, I guess I don't want to spoil the film too much, but like, it's a very bittersweet ending. And you really, I think a lot of people won't know how to feel about it. So it's a kind of a yes and a no. It's like, it can work and it also can't work. And I really don't know. I mean, I suppose I do feel that there's no easy solution to this problem. I really think that we're in for a very like painful like period in, you know, our past is already painful. We're in for some more pain, I think, unfortunately. But I don't know how we can get out of it without kind of going through more, because the damage is too deep, I think.
Yeah, it seems to. Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I was speaking to somebody recently, a psychotherapist who's been focusing and specializing in transgenerational trauma, and this idea that we pass on kind of the trauma, the abuse, the experiences that we've had, we pass that on to our children and our children's children and so on. And it just, it becomes a part of, I'm not a big fan of the phrase, it's a part of my DNA. It's too deterministic for me. It doesn't allow enough freedom and choice. But I wonder to what degree that's it's going to be a factor, it seems to me. But for what I love about your film is you're taking the hard questions on, and you're facing them. And so are your characters, and you know they don't resolve. It doesn't resolve things, but at least it's ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Because you know, without having the answers, all you can do is like set up a platform for the conversation to continue,
nice.
So that maybe other people can have the answers. And sort of that's kind of like ultimately why I made the film, because these things bother me so much, and I didn't know what to do about them, so I made the film.
There's a line, our national anthem. And our flag is BS.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's a South African issue? Do you think that most people around the world feel that way about their government, about their politics, about their history?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I don't know. I suppose it would be a generalization for me to say yes. I mean, because I think from what my understanding of what Tammy is saying when he's saying that is, it is particularly related to the South African context, which is our flag and our anthem, and everything is geared around this concept of the Rainbow Nation, which is, you know, a false ending to a story that hasn't ended. And you know, I know he's referring to that very specifically, but I'm sure similar parallels could be drawn to many other countries, because you know, I suppose what are national anthems do? They're like, they basically say our country is great and
that's
we are
right.
And that's very seldom really the case. I don't know too many countries we could confidently say that about. So I suppose there are anyone who's sort of dissatisfied would, you know, some people will take, you know, kind of comfort in the same way that we take comfort in religion, you know, like there is this thing that's greater than me and it is the country. And other people are, you know, I suppose like oppressed by that, you know, that this country is actually like, it should not be greater than me. This country should be me.
Well, there's something, I think there's something, I don't know if it's ironic or paradoxical or just flat out evil about nationalism. You know, it is about country. It is about flag. It's about us and not about them. It's about pushing out the other, it seems to me, to some degree, you know? And then how do you define what, and how much, how do you define what the flag is and actually means, and how colonial is it, and how imperialistic, and all these things, which are all issues in your film, which is, I guess, why I suppose I asked the question in the first place. You know, sadly, we're going to have to wrap this up soon, and I know this is probably not the question to ask as we come to a close in our conversation, but the question that somebody poses in the film, would you choose to be white, is can we maybe create a university program around that question?
Wow.
I think we need to, you know, and in truth.
I really don't want to be like a facilitator of it, but you're very welcome.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Who's going to come behind that administratively? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, very interesting. It's a profound question, right?
I mean, it's a profound question on so many levels. I don't think it has anything to do really with whiteness, but it's prejudice. I threw it out there.
Mm-hmm. I should answer it, or
You have 3.5 minutes. Okay. I'll set the timer. Go.
Well, I mean, something I suppose that I would say about it is that all the interviews you see in the film are all completely improvised. Mm. So I was interviewing basically the actors as the characters. So it was a strange thing where I was kind of being myself and they were having to be their character. And so that moment came up in the interview where I was asking these questions and these, you know, questions, and I'm kind of really pushing this character Lexi into kind of like confronting the hypocrisy of a lot of what she says.
Right.
And so basically to the point where she like threw it back at me and she said, look, okay, you know, you're white, like you answered the question, you know, like, so, and I really wasn't prepared for that because I mean, this was meant to be an interview. So I was in this weird position of like, she's acting, I'm not acting. So the answer that I give in the film is, kind of like my answer. It's a really hard question to answer, but and especially when you've got very limited time and you're also in your own film suddenly you didn't go before. But that's also why I included it in the film, because for me it felt like the most honest kind of like breakthrough of the movie on a personal level. You know, I don't know about the others, but that's why I felt it had to be in there, because ultimately this film was made by, you know, a white person, and that. Something, you know, that I realized more and more is like, no matter how successful this film is, it's a sad testament to our country that I made this film.
I think it's a profound question, deeply insightful on so many levels. It's really quite remarkable. So there's a line again near the end of the film, and one of the characters says, and I in a kind of a nonplussed way almost, well, I guess we just go back to our normal lives now. And there's something that on one level to me is good about that, I suppose. You know, I've got family, I've got friends, I have a job, I need to stay alive, I need to go back to my hobbies, etc. But in another sense, there's something really tragic to me about that the implication there is, okay, maybe we're not going to now really deal with the issues anymore, because we're now beyond this experience. We can go back to our normal lives in italics.
Yeah, and just like what we thought was normal is actually, I mean, maybe abnormal is not the right word, but normal, like normal is the new bad, you know. it's normal, but it's not good. It's not making us happy, and I think that's the kind of like ambivalence with which she says it. It's like, yeah, I mean, obviously, I could go back to my normal life, so that's a good thing. But I definitely don't think she believes it at that point. I think normal for her has become like practically intolerable. As it is for a lot of people, unfortunately.
Well, I love the film, Jenna. Thank you so much for taking the time today to chat, and I really do look forward to a part two. I hope we can do that. Hopefully we'll get to meet face to face at the film festival. We've been talking to Jenna Bass today about High Fantasy, her new film premiering at the Toronto International Film Festival in the very near future. I love how you just said, Jenna, I think you said something to the effect of, you know, it's kind of a story that hasn't ended. And isn't that, that's the beautiful part of being normal. This is an ongoing conversation. It's an ongoing story. And isn't that wonderful?
Or also scary.
It's absolutely. Hey, Jenna, I was trying to go positive there at the end.
Okay, no, I'm chatting to the wrong person then, sorry.
Listen, what a delight talking to you. It's been such a pleasure, and thank you again for taking the time. High Fantasy, you have to go and see this film. Thanks for your time today, Jenna.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for your questions.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.